So I'm not actually going to focus on computations of the self-force, but rather I'll try to address how can our current knowledge of the self-force better inform us about the various post-Newtonian-based methods that we currently have in hand for computing templates in the comparable mass regime. So in the past few years, we had this very nice result by Barak and Saga, where they computed the gravitational self-force along eccentric geodesics in Schwarzschild. They split the self-force into dissipative and conservative pieces. And specifically, they computed the correction to the ISCO due to this conservative self-force effect. And what they found was this result for the change in the ISCO radius and the change in the ISCO frequency, when you translate their numbers into a form and gauge in which you can readily compare with post-Newtonian results. So this computation is a real milestone, I think, in all the self-force computations. In my view, it's sort of analogous to when numerical relativity computed the first orbit, I would say. So now that we have this... that's out of my hands. So now that we have sort of this nice number, we can go and compare this with our various post-Newtonian methods. So I'd also like to just remind people of the notation I'm going to use throughout this talk, which is a little bit different from the standard self-force notation. By big M, I mean the sum of the masses. Eta is the reduced mass ratio, which is related to the actual mass ratio, which is the ratio of the little black hole to the big black hole. So keep in mind that in addition to this conservative shift in the ISCO, the dissipative self-force also has an effect on the ISCO. In particular, Ori and Thorne several years ago showed that the dissipative self-force causes this blurring of where the ISCO happens. And specifically, they found that this shift in the ISCO has a scaling with the mass ratio to the 2/5 power. So what this tells you is that the conservative, if you look at the ratio of the conservative shift to this dissipative shift, it has this scaling. And actually, the conservative shift is very much smaller than the dissipative shift in the ISCO. So what I think this is telling us is that this conservative shift in the ISCO is not likely to be an observable quantity.
That's why there's no Princeton transfer.
Right. However, its utility really relies on the fact that it's this single unique number, which is readily understood, is gauge invariant, and we can use this number to compare with between various gravitational self-force calculations and also with post-Newtonian and perhaps numerical relativity calculations. So there's a long history of doing comparisons between post-Newtonian frameworks and numerical results. So in particular, after the initial successes in numerical relativity and getting full orbital evolutions in 2005 and 2006, there's a huge stream of papers where people compared with post-Newtonian waveforms to the numerical results, and they tried to, you know, basically quantify what are the various errors associated with different types of PN expansions, try to determine how reliable post-Newtonian templates would be for LIGO searches, and also to comparing the post-Newtonian waveforms to the numerical waveforms, try to calibrate certain undetermined fitting parameters that you can introduce into the various post-Newtonian approaches. In addition to these more recent set of comparison studies, back in 2002, before people could do full numerical relativity, there was this other set of papers which also tried to compare, which at the time were the newly computed 3PN calculations in standard post-Newtonian and effective one-body with quasi-circular initial data computations of the innermost stable circular orbit, or more appropriately, the ICO, the innermost circular orbit. And so now that we have these conservative gravitational self-force calculations, we now have an exact, fully relativistic result, which is not in the comparable mass ratio regime like these two former comparison studies were in, but rather in this extreme mass ratio regime. So now we can further compare post-Newtonian in this different regime and also further try to fit these extra parameters that we can introduce into our post-Newtonian-based approach. So there is also a history of studies that have looked at comparisons in this extreme mass ratio regime. So previously in the 1990s, Eric and Tagoshi and several other people compared just regular black hole perturbation theory, so just the dissipative self-force, with post-Newtonian expressions. And very recently, Steve Detweiler has looked at this gauge invariant redshift function in post-Newtonian theory and compared it with an analogous calculation using a gravitational self-force code. And this has been generalized and extended in more recent works to higher post-Newtonian orders. In another recent paper, De Moore has looked at comparing gravitational self-force calculations with higher order terms, using these gravitational self-force calculations to constrain higher order terms in the effective one-body approach. So the approach that I'll follow here is a little bit different. It's basically to use this shift in the ISCO calculated by Barak and Sago and compare it with all known approaches for computing the ISCO in post-Newtonian theory. So there's around 10 to 15 distinct methods, which I'll now briefly try to go through. You can roughly separate them into two approaches, standard non-resummed approaches and resummed approaches. And so by resummed, I essentially will mean trying to fix up your standard post-Newtonian approaches to try to encapsulate information about the test particle dynamics in Schwarzschild. So the simplest unresummed approach is to just take the minimum of your circular orbit binding energy, which is known to 3PN order, and just find the minimum of this function. So technically, this is an ICO, not an ISCO. But just to keep things simpler, I'm just going to refer to them by ISCO. And depending on the context, you'll know which one I mean. But there is a subtle distinction between the two. Another approach is to do a direct stability analysis of the post-Newtonian equations of motion. And there's various ways in which you could try to do this. You could derive some stability condition for the ISCO and then solve it numerically, or you can then try to post-Newtonian expand that condition. And in that case, you have various choices of variables, whether you use harmonic radio coordinate or ADM radio coordinate, and then solve that equation numerically. Or you can try to come up with a gauge invariant ISCO condition in which you just have some equation which only depends on your frequency, your orbital frequency of the ISCO. So this approach was looked at by Blanchet and Iyer in 2003. You can also play the similar game using the Hamiltonian formulation of the post-Newtonian equations. Now the various resummed approaches. So sort of the first resummed approach, the thing that really started this whole game of effective one body and everything was this Kitterwill-Wiseman hybrid equations of motion. And essentially what that is you take the standard post-Newtonian equations of motion and you look at all the test mass terms and you replace those test mass terms with the Schwarzschild geodesic equation terms written in harmonic gauge. And so they did this at 2PN order and it's very easy to extend that to 3PN order. You can also play the same game using the Hamiltonian formulation of the equations of motion, and this was looked at in this paper. You can also do the same type of hybrid scheme using this energy equation, where you take away, say, these test mass terms and replace them with the exact circular orbit energy in Schwarzschild. There are also a variety of alternative energy functions that De Moore and collaborators looked at, which involve taking some modification of this circular binding energy formula or another equation that's related to the angular momentum and doing a Padé resummation of that formula. And these tend to encapsulate the exact Schwarzschild result in the test mass limit. There's also another thing you can try is you can try to apply a Shank's transformation to any of these methods, which is essentially a type of series acceleration method where given any three terms in a sequence, you can try to guess a subsequent term in the sequence of partial sums that hopefully has better convergence properties, but in practice doesn't always work. And lastly, there's this effective one-body approach, which I'll just briefly describe. The basic idea is you're modeling the two-body problem by looking at the dynamics of a reduced mass particle moving on a deformed Schwarzschild geometry. And so for the purpose of the talk, in computing the ISCO, you have some effective metric. And your ISCO really just depends on what the time-time piece of this EOB metric looks like. And so it has a standard Taylor series expansion that looks like this. And one of the tricks people do is they can add an additional pseudo 4PN term where you don't actually know what this value is and you can try to fit this value. But even in this EOB approach, there are various things you can do. You can take the standard Taylor expansion of that series, or you can do a pod A resummation of this thing. And there's recently been introduced another logarithmic resummation of this thing, of this A of R potential, in a recent paper by Baruse and Buonanno. So now let me just tell you the results. So I forgot to mention, I hope you were paying attention to these purple quantities here, which are going to encode in this long table what the results are. But if you forgot, don't worry about it. So what am I comparing in this table? So this is the method. And this is, if you look at the expansion of the, if you look at the mass ratio expansion of the conservative ISCO shift, this is this coefficient, where this is the value calculated by Barak and Sacco. Right. And so this is based, and so this is what the actual number is, and this is the difference relative to this exact result. Okay, so there are many methods which just do poorly, so I'm just not going to discuss those.
Also rank ordered?
So they're ordered by best methods to the worst methods. So here's, let me just tell you what you need. So the best method ends up being, if you take the 4PN effective one-body approach, and you use a fit to this pseudo 4PN parameter from the Caltech Cornell numerical relativity simulations to the 2-2 waveform. So just the fit that they happen to come up with happens to produce very good agreement with this Barak-Sacco result, which I think is kind of interesting that a calculation which is done on equal mass ratio does very well at matching a totally independent calculation in the extreme mass ratio case. It's an interesting coincidence. If you look at the standard EOB method without introducing any free parameters, that comes in here with an error of around 30% or so. So it doesn't do horribly, but it's not the best method. You can then ask, well, what is the best method that doesn't involve any kind of calibration? And it turns out that the best method is this gauge invariant stability condition for the ISCO that was derived by Blanchet and Iyer. And it doesn't involve any sort of resummation. And it has sort of a very interesting property. Basically, if you look at what that condition turns out to be, it's this expression here, where x is related to the frequency at the ISCO. And you set this expression equal to 0 and solve for x, and that tells you what the ISCO frequency is. And so you notice that that this expression exactly reproduces the test mass result. So if you set 8 equal to 0, you get x equals 1 over 6, which is the Schwarzschild ISCO. So without any sort of resummation entered by hand, somehow the post-Newtonian, you know, this way of calculating the ISCO in post-Newtonian knows about the Schwarzschild ISCO. And it also happens to agree very nicely with this Barak-Sacco result. So I think that's very interesting. So another thing you can do, just because if you compute the ISCO, you might as well do it for another interesting case. You can also compare with the equal mass case. So in this case, you're not technically comparing ISCO, you're comparing an ITO. And so the comparison is with a calculation by Harold, in this paper, Caudill et al., in which they use sequences of quasi-circular initial data to compute the ISCO for an equal mass binary, and they find this value. So you can then do this same game where you do all the methods. And it turns out the best method happens to be this this J method, which I don't want to go into. I think it's just sort of luck. that one works well. But I just want to point out that the standard 3PN energy function approach works very well in this case. So in both the equal mass case and the extreme mass ratio case, there are standard post-Newtonian methods that don't rely on resummation that match numerical calculations very well. So this just is a summary, most of which I already told you. The only other thing I wanted to mention was, I guess I was always curious about the Kitterwill-Weisman hybrid equations in motion and how well they would do if you extend those to 3PN order. And they don't really. They work better in that sense that they get the ISCO going and the ISCO correction going in the correct direction this time, which they were going in the wrong direction in 2PN order. But they still don't behave very well. For example, the 1PN version of this works much better than the 3PN version.
So this doesn't seem to be a good scheme to use for generating temperature.
Okay, now I'd like to talk some more about this sort of special Blaché-Ayer-Isco condition. And I'd especially like to explore this feature that it has.
How much time? Running out of time.
1 minute? Okay. So an interesting question you could ask, well, is maybe this is just a coincidence that it reproduces this test mass, the Schwarzschild-Isco in the test mass case. So one simple thing you can do is try to just extend their calculation to a spinning black hole. So forget about conservative self-force corrections for a moment. Let's just examine this ISCO condition in the case of Kerr. And so what you can do is you can compute the condition for the Kerr-ISCO in terms of an angular frequency. So this expression is essentially equivalent to the standard ISCO expression you'll find in Bardeen-Fresenius pulses. And you can then expand this condition in terms of the spin parameter, where chi2 is the spin of your Kerr black hole, and it has some expansion in spin. There's no expansion in post-Newtonian, just the spin. And you can then go and repeat the Blaché-Ayer analysis using our current knowledge of spin terms in post-Newtonian, up to the best order we know, 2.5 pn spin orbit, 2 pn in spin-spin, and quantum. And when you do that, you can now produce another ISCO condition and compare it with this condition you get from the Kerr spacetime. And so the full condition looks like this, but if you specialize it to the test particle limit and just look at the Kerr ISCO, you get this quantity here. And essentially what you find is you find agreement between this post-Newtonian expression and the exact Kerr expression up to the order with which you could expect them to agree. So for example, we only know the spin terms up to spin squared, so I can't compare the higher order spin terms. But in the regime in which you can do the comparison using your current knowledge of post-Newtonian, you find that somehow this post-Newtonian analysis of the ISCO has some knowledge of what the Kerr ISCO is. So this is a very curious fact. So potentially in the future, once people have computed the ISCO shift using the conservative self-force, it'd be nice to see how that compares to this expression. So how much overtime am I?
You're 2 minutes into your question period.
Okay, so maybe I will leave this for the discussion later, but I was going to talk a little bit about how you can use perhaps numerical relativity combined with gravitational self-force calculations to try to fix higher order PN terms in the energy function. But I'll leave that for later. And let me just summarize my take-home message. So first of all, one of the things I think people should note is when you have this effective one-body approach that is very popular for generating templates, this approach enforces exact agreement in the test particle limit. But when you start to look at small deviations from the test particle limit, it's not guaranteed to sort of produce accurate results. It's really only defined to produce good results in the test particle limit. And once you go past that, you're sort of limited by whatever your PN knowledge you have put into this effective one-body approach. So this is especially a warning if you try to use effective one-body to look at, say, second-order self-force effects by modeling Emery waveforms using the effective one-body approach. Just a word of caution if you try to do that. It's not necessarily guaranteed to produce some results that are going to be as accurate as the pulse self-force. However, I just want to go on record that I think effective one-body is awesome. It has a lot of useful, it's very adept at fitting numerical relativity simulations, but it has a lot of wonderful uses. Also, I just want to emphasize that it looks like the standard post-Newtonian equations sort of have some interesting cards up its sleeve. So it reproduces the conservative ISCO shift very well, and it also seems to have this weird knowledge about what the ISCO is without any sort of reasoning. As I sort of didn't really get to talk about, you can use these gravitational self-force calculations, either the ISCO shift or these other calculations that I'm sure other people will talk about very shortly, to calibrate various parameters that show up either in your effective one-body metric or in, say, your post-Newtonian energy function.
So I'll leave it there and try to take some questions.